For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
All I can hear, I be mine, I be mine, I be mine. Even those tears, I be mine, I be mine, I be mine. No one's frightened of playing it, everyone's saying it, flowing more freely than wine. All through your life, I be mine, I be mine, I be mine. I me me man.
So good evening, Bodhisattvas. We're in the approaching the darkness of winter. There's a little sadness in this song, written by George Harrison, for those of you who remember the Beatles. Feeling old. So recently I walked into the temple kitchen and there was a magazine called Buddha Dharma, and on the cover was His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And I picked it up and it said, "The suffering and happiness each of us experiences is a reflection of the distortion or clarity with which we view ourselves and the world." And I'm like, And then it says, "The profound mind of the Dalai Lama." So I'm like, I think I'll take this. I'll borrow this from Ancient Dragon. So I signed it out of the library. And I guess I was interested in, wow, what is he talking about here? Suffering and happiness depends on this reflection. It is a reflection of the distortion or clarity with which we view ourselves in the world. And his face looked very serious. Usually His Holiness the Dalai Lama is jovial, right? Laughing and hanging out. There's something serious business about this. I opened it up. And, you know, he's like, seeing ourselves clearly. And he quotes from a commentator on the great Buddhist teaching of emptiness of inherent self-existence. And he says, Dharmakirti says, "When there is grasping at self, discrimination between self and other arises. Emotions and afflictions then follow." So I'm like, I think I'll investigate that a little bit. Now, most everyone here has been to Ancient Dragon before. Is anyone new? I don't know every single person's name, but I have a sense that many of you have been practicing much of your lives and are very devoted practitioners. So you all know that what His Holiness is talking about, you know, is the right view regarding the self. And this might be known in other terms as non-separation of self and other. But George Harrison, who wrote this little tune we sang, said, in writing about a commentary on his own song, said, "I me mine is the ego problem." And, you know, it's not a new concept with Buddhism that I me mine is a little bit of a problem for humans. You know, certainly ancient Indian texts cite that as a little problem. And I'm not really so interested tonight in the philosophy behind this, but I'm interested in how we all experience this in our lives and our meditation practice, this grasping at self, this I me mine, I want it my way, you know. I'm right. This is the way things should be according to my ideas. And this is this little self nugget is, I think, sort of our great Buddhist project, maybe, on our cushions. And I am really just speaking tonight to share with you the thing that I'm working with in my practice, and also encourage you to unravel the subtlety of clinging, the little grasper that we have embedded in our physiology, I think, as well as in our hearts and our minds. And this doesn't mean, of course, be stupid and get rid of a self or whatever, be self-abusive. You all know better than that. But I think it is serious business and quite profoundly sad. And I think that George Harrison's song is a little homage to the pathos of this little human addiction that creates affliction. It'd be a rap song. Addiction creates affliction. You got a self? Something like that. And I probably suspect that most of us in our sitting practice have encountered this little nugget of self, and the pain that of coming close to and connecting to the consequences of this separation, which we cannot help as humans. You know, it's sad to not get what ego wants. It is sad. It's actually sad to let go and give up grasping. And what I've been sort of in touch with a little bit is kind of the grief, you know, the mourning process that I think we go through in our practice. It's a wholesome sadness, but I think grieving the giving up of the grasper, or the diminution, maybe we never completely give it up, but the relaxation of the grasper is a painful process. You know, on the way of to opening our hearts. It's interesting in here. Actually, the Dalai Lama says something that I found very interesting. If I can find it, I'll share it with you. Yes. Buddha taught many practices by which happiness can grow in our lives, such as acting generously towards others and rejoicing in their virtues. But these do not directly oppose our distorted grasping at a notion of self. The qualities that these practices engender cannot provide us with the ultimate state of happiness, freedom from suffering. Only the insight into selflessness, and I would say the full acknowledgement and acceptance of our selfishness, with is the direct antidote to our ignorant self-grasping. So I thought that was kind of interesting. Like, you can practice all you want, but until you really are face-to-face and fully aware and given up this little grasper, does liberation occur? But I want to invite you maybe to explore this process of mourning and what goes on, mourning this grasper, mourning having everything my way. And there are lots of different ways to conceptualize like a grieving process. But I'm sort of borrowing a little bit from Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who looked at the grieving process in death and dying that people go through when they face their own death. And I thought, well, that's kind of a little self-esque. We have to help little self with that process. So it's interesting. The first stage, you know, is this kind of denial and ignorance and confusion. So, you know, the Kubler-Ross, I'm sort of riffing on it a little bit, but she was somebody who studied dying people and the process they went through in coping with usually terminal illness. And the first is sort of this kind of ignorance or denial or confusion. Then there's some anger. Then there's anxiety. usually some kind of bargaining, like I want to get out of this. Maybe I can pretend it ain't so. And then that sort of leads to sadness and despair. And then there's sort of an acceptance, which we might say is sort of a precursor to liberation. But I think we can look at examples just in personal experience, you know, of this sort of first stage, let's say, of a little denial or ignorance. Like, you know, practice is going great. No problems, right? You know, I was thinking of Dogen, when the famous story that many of you know where Dogen meets this Tenzo, and the Tenzo has to go to take care of the Sangha, and Dogen is like, you know, dude, why are you leaving? Hang out and talk to me. Don't you want to talk to me? I mean, you know, somebody else can provide the food and order out or something. And the Tenzo's like, you got a ways to go, my friend. I've got to walk 20 miles back to my village with the mushrooms I just bought to prepare a nice meal. And afterwards, Dogen, that sunk in for him, I think. But that's sort of confronting a little bit of ignorance, right? And a little bit of like, maybe I'm a little bit self-focused. Like I was thinking, this guy had walked 20 miles to go buy these mushrooms and had the patience to sit and share the Dharma with Dogen before going back. And I would have been like, oh, maybe I'll let you rest. But this is the energy that bodhisattvas get, I guess, over time. You know, in the early days of it was a personal example of ignorance. There are many of which you probably know if you've known me for a while, but I'll share one with Taigen. In the early days of our Sangha, Taigen was still living in California, and after our Monday night Zazen, at some points, you know, we talk, and he would request that I give him sort of a rundown of who came to the temple and how many people were there. And I was like, counting away. Now, how many were there? 15? Were there 10? You know, were they students from DePaul, or were these like regular people? And, you know, and Taigen said, so did you count all the beings that you couldn't see in the room? And I was like, aha, thank you. I've never forgotten that, Taigen. I want to thank you very much for that. You know, it was a reminder of my ignorance, and I was very grateful for that. I still am. So that's a great lesson in this kind of separation, too, of wanting to parse out, this is what I see, you know, this is what's really there. So just a little example. Anger might be something that is another clue. And all of these kind of emotions, which you could say were afflictive experiences or emotions, actually are the seeds of awakening. And they're part of our practice, so we feel them in our body. So anger might arise. Like, I can sense it, I could sense it, and I'm sure Titus may sense it at some point. If you ask someone in the kitchen, you know, could you please chop the vegetables in this way? And somebody gives you a look. Well, but I've been chopping vegetables my whole life. Isn't this the right way? And I'm like, no, I'm Tenzo. My way's the right way. but there's something in our interactions with each other in the Sangha that this is what happens, you know. Even wearing all these robes and having to deal with these garments as a priest is sort of like, what's the right way, you know? And I've got it right, you know. Every time I think I'm doing something correct, I go someplace else, and they're like, oh, no, we do it this way here. So this is, and but, you know, there's like this indignance, this kind of outrage. You know, wait a minute, the Eno was correcting me? I was Don. And the Eno said, no, I should ring the bell this time. And then, but no, see, it's in the book, right? I'm right. So there's... Watch that. This is a little bit of the grasper trying to hang on. And so you have to be gentle, you know, The antidote is caring, holding that little grasper. But there's so many opportunities with this experience of grieving to open up your hearts and relax. Let go of hundreds of years, right? Another thing that sort of happens along this way, so like after you're kind of angry, when you really start to realize, oh, I'm going to have to give something up, there's usually fear. And the response to fear for most people is avoidance. Like, I want to get out of doing that. Sleep in for zazen in a temple. But, fear usually arises. Like, I can't do this. Oh, my God, I can't sit through one more period of zazen. Maybe I'll get sick. I'll get a sore stomach. Okay, I can get out of it then. You know, so in our practice, you'll see these things. Or, I don't want to be Kokyo. I'll always sign up for greeter because I don't want people to know that my voice isn't beautiful. And the little grasper wants to be beautiful and perfect all the time, unless it has many forms. It's quite relentless. So I remember one form mine took. I went to a Zen teacher and said, I'm just not worthy of practicing Buddhism. It's such a beautiful thing, and I'm not worthy of it. And she was like, well, that's negative self-clinging.
Yes.
Let's start talking about something serious. So there's this other sort of like hanging on to the little nugget that's not good enough. A little nugget that couldn't, So this self, has these kind of manifestations, but when it's anxious, it's afraid. It's you feel kind of contracted, and you don't want to, show people, or you don't want to take a risk in your life to, let somebody else be who they are and really meet them. I was thinking of this and this kind of fear and avoidance of difficulty in practice. And this is something that comes up as kind of an obstacle in practice when things start to, once like the bliss of zazen wears off. May it never wear off for any of you. But there tends to be sort of like all the reasons to give practice up when it's a little difficult. And in the Avatamsaka Sutra, there's this great story. So the final book, I think it's called Entry into the Realm of Reality. There is a spiritual seeker, an amazing Buddhist practitioner. I mean, this person's like super enthusiastic, and he's, going to visit all these teachers till he gets final, nirvana, enlightenment. And learns the perfections of being a super bodhisattva. So he cruises around, talks to all these teachers, and on his way, and it was interesting because usually, like, every teacher he goes to will say, yeah, go down the road. You think my samadhi was amazing? This other person is just, like, unbelievable. And he's going along, and he comes up to one fairly early on. So all these teachers are, like, great, and there's, jewels and fragrant flowers raining down, and their samadhis are just like, concentrations beyond any imagination. And it's all really like great. It sounds like so much fun. But he comes up to one guy who's Dayashmayatna, who's called Overcoming the Heat of Emotional Afflictions. And he's in the guise of a ascetic Brahmin, long hair, he's got fires burning all around him, purging himself through heat. And he comes up to him and is like, oh, great enlightened person, teach me how to be even more, a better bodhisattva. And this guy says, you see that mountain with razor peaks over there? And there's this huge fire, burning cauldron fire, climb that thing and then jump into the fire. So Sudhana, who was so enthusiastic, is like, maybe this guy is actually a fake. Maybe he's actually trying to lead me in the wrong way. And maybe I don't really have to do this. And then there's a bunch of other bodhisattvas who are like, go on, do it. This guy's for real. And he climbs the peak and jumps into the fire and gets enlightened. But there was this, you know, even in this amazing kind of character, he's like going, maybe there's some way out of this. Maybe I don't have to climb that razor. This road seemed fine to me. I don't have to jump into this fire. Of course, the fire is what a metaphor for, you know, the burning up of these afflictions. And so there does come a time when the grasper's sort of exhausted from all of this resistance, you could say, that there's a despair. And I think it's a wholesome kind of sadness, of like the jig is up, and relinquishment is around the corner. The relinquishment of continually feeding this kind of idea of self that's separate and reified. And I thought, I was thinking about this, and I heard on National Public Radio, I don't know if anybody heard this, there was a report on a study of tantrums. Did you hear this? You're a dad, right?
Yeah.
So these scientists did a quantitative study of tantrums in children. Your dad too? You're all dads. A bunch of dads around here. Any moms? There's mom here too. A couple moms. Yeah. So these scientists put little onesies on these toddlers and recorded their vocalizations and body movements during tantrums. And what they found was that there's this pitch of anger that's sort of the peak of a tantrum, but running through it is a whimper of sadness. And the instructions that the psychologist gave were something like, you know, let the anger peak and don't do anything, which most parents probably have learned. But the line I loved was, when the whimper happens and when a child is sad, they reach out for comfort. And I think this is a fruit of this sadness we feel in practice when we're giving up, is we're reaching out then for comfort to each other, and to we begin to see our connection to the universe. And this, to me, is a transformed quality of grasping, is embracing and sustaining all beings. And this embracing. So even in your sadness, just around the corner is Buddha. And of course, you know, this is a spiral of practice. You know, we go through these stages, I think, of grieving again and again in our lives. And in each of these moments of loss, I think, we have, of course, the support of Sangha and such things as the paramitas, generosity, forbearance, upright conduct, spiritual strength, meditative concentration and wisdom, you could say. And then we find our way, you know, together to drop the burden of the grasper and embrace this true self. You know, I mean, no, I think nobody says it better than Dogen. You know, the entire universe is the true body of the self. But that's, all these things sound good, you know. You know, gaining is delusion, loss is enlightenment, the entire universe is the true body of the self. Philosophically, I mean, you know, there's reams in Buddhist literature written on this topic. But to feel it, I think we have to feel our way in our practice together. So when I am preparing, you could say, to go on a little bit of an extended monastic retreat, which I'm about to do in January, this is what I start to do, is I start to cook with something like this in practice. So I want to just thank you for encouraging me and allowing me to share this with you. And please share any of your responses, Bodhisattvas.
Thank you. I like the radio story you told of the, it's kind of deep, that within the sadness, within the frustration of tantrum, there's that whimper, that sadness. Anyways, I think that to see that and acknowledge that's really important is maybe what we could call tantrum Buddhism. Often within one emotion that seems difficult, there are many. Below anger, there's fear. Below fear, there's sadness. So this investigation is important.
So thank you very much for the talk and the singing. I know that when I sit and I have different kind of clinging or kind of ego things going on, and maybe then I try and push them away, and then I think that then that turns into something, and then it gets to be like it feels like, you know, I always feel it, and it feels like it's like pulling or pushing, or, you know, it feels like this kind of battle going on for sure. And and then sometimes I find myself just watching that then, and I fall into that, and so that's kind of can be a nice thing, but it's certainly I kind of go into this battle mode of like and I could feel it kind of like when just talking about it, like what that, you know, I could kind of feel that sensation. But I really like this. Thank you very much. I get to.
Too old to do, and pulled a hamstring or a glute or something, and so sitting has been even more physically painful than it usually is. And it's been really interesting because for a while I felt like conceptually I could sort of understand clinging and craving, and I felt like I was doing really good at letting go of that. But pain is a whole other thing.
Yes, it is.
And it feels really mine. And it's been really interesting to look at that. It really feels like this is my really sore right butt cheek. And nobody else understands what this is like. And of course, everyone else has their own aches and pains. And I've been feeling like, you know, oh, well, I know, I can sit for 10 less minutes. I can sit for 15 less minutes. And I've been going through the same thing that Donna was just talking about like, I'm not going to pay attention to it. And that doesn't work at all. So I don't know what the grieving is, except maybe that I'm too old to be doing what I try to do.
Yeah, the sadness.
But thank you for talking about this. It was really connected with me quite a bit.
That pain piece, the physical pain, is sort of a great teacher in practice, right? That'll focus you. I think somebody said to someone at Zen Center once, Suzuki Roshi actually, I think he might have said it to Mel. It was like, oh, everything's going great. Suzuki Roshi said, well, sit in full lotus for every period then. You bargain. So thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
You know, I don't think we need to look for pain.
No.
It's, you know, if things are going well, that's great, you know. I hope that's happening for everyone. And yet, at some point, if you pay attention enough, there's some problem.
Yeah. Yes.
And then, yeah, how do we face that and what's the sadness of that?
Yes, I did not mean to, you know, injure yourself, go into self-mutilation. Because that's also like, you know, Buddha says, you know, addiction to, you know, self-mortification is just as bad as addiction to bliss. But the hamstring needs care.
Do I have it right that grieving the loss of the grasping self leads to non-separation? Do I have that right?
Explore it. It's the idea.
Okay.
It's part of the process. Let's say it doesn't lead to it, but there's a process that I think happens for humans.
Okay.
I think mammals in general. but I think, so you know, you can say, oh yeah, we're all one, you know, or I'm really practicing non-separation. But actually, there's a process to that that's not intellectual, that's physical and felt. That's what I feel.
Mm. That's what I... Because a lot of times the big statements like the entire universe is the truth, but it doesn't mean anything to me. and I wonder if you could sometimes some example that my intellect can grab onto is helpful.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if there's a way that you can articulate for me the. But through an example of that would show that, like the grieving the loss of the grasping self leads to the non-separation, and you're saying explore it, which I probably have been doing. And,
yes, absolutely.
And then what is the manifestation of when I'm no longer separate from Douglas?
You won't know it. But you might be closer. Because you know, what is the manifestation?
Yeah.
Don't know. It's most intimate.
But also the practice of non-separation, to put it that way, is to really be intimate and study, and I think this is what you're talking about, the ways in which we do feel or see or imagine separation. Just like the practice of patience is to study our own patterns of impatience. It's by facing this stuff, as Hogetsu is talking about.
Here might be an example. A friend of mine, who's an intense Zen practitioner, an all-around good Nick, has a habit of correcting his wife. And
in what way?
Well, like they were in the kitchen the other day.
Uh-huh.
And he said, you know, she was preparing something, cracking eggs. And he had worked in Zen kitchens for a long time, so of course there's a lot of ideas about how things should be done. And so he put a little bowl next to her, helped her out. Like, you might want to use this to help you with this. And she said, you know what? I've been cracking eggs my whole life. Does it always have to be your way? And he said, thank you very much, my dear. And he said, you know, I had this tendency, I realized, to kind of correct people from being at Zen Center correcting people all these years. But and I wasn't respecting my wife in this moment. And so that was a little painful for him. But also, it brought them closer. So I think this is a little bit of how this works. Yes.
Jen.
I had a very emotional response to science. And I can remember when I was in school and the teacher told us that every single cell in your body has a complete complement of DNA. Now, can't be. And I said, really? And I was just astonished by that. But then I'm older, and so, you know, that information came into the, I want to say lexicon, much later in my life than it did for most everybody else here. But I was just knocked out by that. And then learning that every element is created in the interior of stars, and that each time there's a supernova, those elements are scattered throughout the universe, and at some point, the dust collects, and the solar system is formed. And if we've got a carbon atom in our bodies, it was created in the interior of an exploding star. Mm. And these things just... I'm just... I can hardly stand it.
You know? That's right.
And then someone wrote into Dan Savage. No, it wasn't.
Oh, let's hear Dan Savage.
It was something I read online, but it could have been in Dan Savage. It wasn't. And this woman wrote in and she said, I know what it was. It was American Fork, Utah, where a lot of my cousins live. And they have passed an ordinance in American Fork that they will respect civil arrangements between same-sex couples. And of course, in a place like American Fork, this gets a huge response. And a woman wrote into this, it was something I got online, and she said, I don't mind people being gay, but she says, I wish they wouldn't have to do it in public or show in public, you know. And somebody wrote back who was gay, and he said, I can no more not be gay in public than you can be not girl in public, you know. And I wrote in and said, you know, human sexuality has been in the works for at least a billion years, at least. Probably 2 or 3. And there's no way that we can not be the sexual beings that we've become. And to me, it all fits in with, this may be, oh, I get far-fetched. This may be it's part of all of how we developed in the universe. And it's part of the elements that go up to make who we are and what we are. And sexuality is a product of this. So I don't know how it's so easy for me to feel one with the universe, but I do. And I don't know if it's not anything that I have to work at.
I'm very glad. There is, though, this intense response sometimes, right? Like the beauty and the complexity of existence, you could say, of non-existence, of our lives, is pretty intense. And you seem like you're able to like hang out with it, which I think is good. But I think sometimes that intensity freaks us out. You know, people...
Oh, it doesn't.
Yeah, right. So then there's a tendency usually when we're afraid to like kind of go, no, that's not quite right. But I think it's, we just know a tiny bit, you know. So thank you for illustrating that the entire universe is a true human body. How does that sound? Is that a pretty good argument?
Oh, no.
I like that one myself.
I really appreciate that, yeah. Mm-hmm.